The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is titled, How to Watch Hallmark Christmas Movies Without Cable. With 41 original offerings, this year's Hallmark Channel Christmas movie slate promises to be one you don't want to miss, featuring a Back to the Future cast reunion and the return of stars like Lacey Chabert and Candace Cameron Bure. But with more people cutting the cord on cable subscriptions, some may think that this staple of the Yuletide season is out of reach. Luckily, there are plenty of ways to watch Hallmark's Christmas movies, even if you don't have cable. Hallmark has gotten into the mobile game with its own series of apps. Plus, plenty of other services can provide access to the vast Hallmark catalog, albeit for a monthly fee. To help you get ready to hunker down for the holidays and de-stress at the end of a chaotic year, here are all the ways that you can watch and stream Hallmark's Christmas films, including Hallmark Movies and Mysteries films, without a traditional cable package. You can watch the 2021 Hallmark Christmas movies through several different streaming services. Many popular streaming options allow users to watch Hallmark features. These include Sling, which provides access to the Hallmark Channel for $35 a month with $10 off the first month, as well as Philo, which has the three Hallmark channels at a rate of $25 a month. Friendly TV emphasizes content for all ages and has all three Hallmark channels as well, starting at $5.99 a month, albeit with fewer additional programming options than more established networks. Fubo TV is a pricier option, with its main plan running $64.99 for a month, but it offers nearly 120 channels, including all three Hallmark options. Older Hallmark films are a bit harder to find. Few streaming services carry Hallmark movies from previous years, and while several can be found in places like Amazon Prime, your best bet is Hallmark Movies Now, which we'll touch on below. Hallmark has several apps for mobile and its own streaming service. Hallmark has its own series of apps, including Hallmark TV in the Google Play Store, and the aforementioned Hallmark Movies Now, which is the best bet for passionate Hallmark fans. There are two payment plans available for their service. The first is $59.99 annual plan, which balances out to $4.99 a month but requires upfront payment, or a $5.99 monthly plan. Both options come with a 7-day free trial. HMN not only has new Christmas movies, but hundreds of older films and television shows that the channel has created. It includes content from all three networks, Hallmark Channel, Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, and Hallmark Hall of Fame. It costs $4.99 a month with their annual plan. Netflix doesn't carry Hallmark movies, but there's a way to get them on Amazon Prime Video. Perhaps because Netflix has been throwing its hat into the original Christmas programming arena, the service presently doesn't have any Hallmark holiday movies available. But we've got plenty of Netflix Christmas flick suggestions that scratch a similar itch, whether you're looking for something the kids will love or a classic you may remember from your own childhood, including The Princess Switch, Christmas Wedding Planner, and The Holiday Calendar. An Amazon Prime subscription by itself won't get you access to its vast archive of Hallmark movies, but if you pair it with the $5.99 a month Hallmark Movies Now subscription, then you can watch everything, including the 2020 releases, through Prime. Our next article is entitled, This Inspiring Survivor Has Faced Ovarian Cancer Three Times. Each year in the U.S., approximately 22,000 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Unfortunately, the signs and symptoms of this disease are hard to recognize, so women often don't learn they have cancer until it has advanced to later stages. This is exactly what happened to GSK spokesperson Dana M., who shared her inspiring story with us in the video above. Back in 1997, following a routine well woman exam, Dana's gynecologist recommended she get a sonogram of her abdomen. He stated that he felt something that wasn't quite right, so he wanted to be sure, Dana recalls. When the sonogram showed there were masses in her abdomen, her OBGYN told her she needed exploratory surgery to see what was going on. A week later, Dana underwent the recommended surgery, but things took an unexpected turn. During the procedure, a gynecologic oncologist was called in to assist. When Dana woke up post-op, he was there waiting to speak to her. I learned that I had masses of tumors growing within my abdomen and pelvic region. They were able to save my organs with the exception of the one fallopian tube that had survived an earlier ectopic pregnancy, one ovary, my uterus, and my appendix, Dana says. A few days later, Dana had a post-op visit with her doctor where she learned that the tumors removed during her surgery were cancerous. Much to her disbelief, she was officially diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. The news was especially shocking because she was just 25 years old. Dana recalls, "In my mind, cancer was an elderly disease, not a young woman's disease. Definitely not this young woman's." The median age of a woman diagnosed with ovarian cancer is 63. Although her doctors were able to cut away all the tumorous growth, her care team wanted to be sure no cancerous cells had traveled to other parts of her body. So Dana underwent chemotherapy. The treatment was successful and Dana's health remained stable for over a decade. When she was 43, Dana learned the cancer had returned. This isn't unusual for those with ovarian cancer. Approximately 85% of women with the disease will see the cancer return. "I went through chemo, the tumor shrunk and were not a threat anymore," Dana says. Dana thought she was in the clear, but 2 years later, the cancer reared its ugly head again. This time, she was treated with chemotherapy every 3 weeks for almost a year. "It was the hardest time of my life. I was much older, so my body was slower to bounce back, not to mention my mindset being tossed everywhere by the news," she remembers. Another year went by. Then Dana had a cancer antigen blood test, also known as a CA125. This led to additional tests, including a computerized tomography, or CT scan, and biopsy, which confirmed her cancer had returned once more. Observation, or watch and wait, was the standard approach between Dana's treatments, which she found challenging. "I've always been the person who takes life by the horns," she says. So when her oncologist spoke with her about maintenance therapy options that could potentially delay the time before the cancer returned following a response to chemotherapy, she was intrigued. "I like the idea that I would have a medicine in my system that might help delay the cancer from returning after my successful chemotherapy cycles." After discussing all the benefits and risks with her oncologist, Dana decided to try maintenance therapy. Dana has been on maintenance therapy for several years now and has regular monitoring visits with her doctor. She also makes sure to tell her doctor about any side effects she experiences. "Knowing that I'm doing everything I can to actively support my own care provides me that extra nudge to keep pressing," Dana says. "I share my story as often as possible and do what I can to reach out to others facing a scary diagnosis." Our next article by Jonathan Borge is titled, "Brené Brown Didn't Get a Netflix Special by Manifesting. She Worked Her Ass Off." Motivational authors like Eckhart Tolle, Ayanna Van Zant, and yes, O's very own Oprah, help us understand how to live more fully. But there's one trait that separates New York Times bestselling writer and University of Houston research professor Brené Brown from the pack. She's obsessed with data. That may not sound sexy, but Brown has managed to whip up her academic findings. She studies big picture topics like shame, vulnerability, and courage into books, Daring Greatly, Dare to Lead, and headline-making TEDx talks. Hers is one of the most popular of all time, that not only make followers want to become better versions of themselves, but also encourage them to turn to their friends and ask, "Wait, have you heard of Brené Brown?" Now the 53-year-old Texan girl with a husband and two children, also a regular guest on Oprah's Super Soul Conversations podcast, is inspiring people across the globe to live fearlessly through her Netflix special, The Call to Courage. In it, she uses funny and relatable anecdotes from her work and personal life to teach viewers how to find more love, joy, and belonging within themselves. But how does she know which often heavy discussions will click with audiences? It's all in the data, of course. "I'm a grounded theory researcher, so we develop theories based on people's lived experiences, searching for patterns that saturate so heavily across diverse populations," she tells OprahMag.com. "My job is to name these themes in a way that resonates with people so that, for example, When someone says, "What's that feeling when you wake up the next day and think, I shouldn't have said that?" I can answer with, "Oh, the vulnerability hangover." Brown says she's no celebrity, but it's undeniable she's quickly becoming a household name, making TV appearances with Gayle King on CBS This Morning and posing in front of enormous promotional billboards planted in LA and New York. Fun fact, her Netflix special was released just days apart from Beyoncé's Homecoming documentary, which she describes as a sheer triumph. That release date alone made it pretty hard for fans to miss her 76-minute debut on the streaming platform. We caught up with Brown to discuss the call to courage, how to actually let your guard down, and the best advice she's ever gotten from the O of O. You revisit the importance of vulnerability in this new special, explaining how welcoming vulnerability and being courageous only leads to joy, belonging, and love. Can you provide examples of vulnerability? Vulnerability is about showing up and going all in when you don't know what the outcome is going to be. The answers people give us in our research range from the first date after my divorce, trying to get pregnant after my second miscarriage, starting my own business, firing someone, getting fired, waiting for my daughter to get college acceptance letters, waiting for my oncologist to call back. Another example is telling your partner how excited you are about a job, even though you don't know if you'll get it, as opposed to acting like you don't care. You also tell viewers that some of life's greatest moments come from the tough things, like grief and heartbreak. That's an optimistic outlook. Is it ever hard for you to keep your chin up? No, because what's the alternative to being all in? It's armor. It's putting on 500 pounds of armor to protect yourself when A, it's really not going to protect you, but B, it is going to suffocate you and prevent you from growing into your gift. How can we let go of that armor you say we protect ourselves with? To start, a great question is, when I'm afraid of uncertainty, what is my go-to behavior? Do I get perfectionistic? Do I start pleasing? Am I an avoider? Do I pretend like it's not happening? Do I get mean? Do I get controlling? More than even fear, vulnerability is about managing uncertainty and discomfort. Because let me tell you, feelings are real. The awkwardness, the discomfort, the squirminess that it causes in us. Those are real emotions and real physiological feelings. You're great at being inclusive in the way you communicate, always representing various groups of people. Is that intentional? It's honestly the way I was raised academically. I've got a bachelor's degree and PhD in social work, and we were using inclusive language 20 years ago. If you can't be bothered enough to change a frame on a word or a pronoun that's hurting someone, I don't get that. I don't do it great. I've got to stop saying women and men so much because we know better now than to use that binary. It's hard as a researcher because we still use those categories, but I'm really committed to that. We need to keep paying attention until no one on the playground is getting beat up. In a trailer for the special, you mentioned that 20 years ago, you told your husband you wanted to start a global conversation about shame and vulnerability. How did you accomplish that? Was it through manifestation? Hard work and luck. I'm not a real big believer in manifesting unless you define manifesting as setting a goal, working your ass off, and being in the right place at the right time. I definitely don't underestimate the role of luck and opportunity, and I certainly don't underestimate the work. I couldn't even get anyone to publish my first book. I self-published it and sold it out of my trunk. People always say Brené Brown's meteoric rise, and I'm like, that's going to be the slowest freaking meteor in the whole world because that's just not how it went. I love that your special came out the day after Beyoncé's Homecoming, and everyone tuning into Netflix sees your face on there. What's it like to become more recognizable? I'd say you're a celebrity. I swear I don't identify at all with the word celebrity. I just don't. I thought Beyoncé's Homecoming was sheer triumph. I don't see myself like that. I see myself as a really lucky research professor. What's the best piece of advice you've gleaned from Oprah? I don't remember what the direct quote is, but she basically said, if you think you're going to do the work you want and live the life you want without disappointing people or pissing them off, you don't understand. That's life. Keep doing your work. I have a rapid-fire round of words I'd love you to react to. Shame, courage. Vulnerability, strength. Belonging, joy. Trust, slow. Oprah, love. What's your definition of success? That I'm living a life surrounded by people I love, doing work I care about, that I think will make the world a better place. By my definition, I absolutely believe I'm successful. What's your biggest fear and how do you attempt to overcome it? Do you want the bullshit answer or the real answer? I sometimes am afraid I'm not doing enough because I'm worried about the world. I'm worried about everything from systemic racism and poverty to the environment. I get super overwhelmed by it. And then I just remember that other people are doing great things and I'm just going to do my piece and that it's okay for me to rest and inhale sometimes. I don't have to be exhaling 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. When the going gets tough, is it hard for you to take your own advice? It's always hard for me to take my own advice. The longest standing advice that I have in my life is from Dr. Maya Angelou, and I started reading her 3 decades ago. During a recent Super Soul conversation with Oprah, you paraphrased Maya Angelou, reminding people that they have to love themselves before expecting anyone to trust them. What can we do to love ourselves? Challenge the narrative. Challenge the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, because those will absolutely do us in. Name one thing you changed as a result of your research that made your life better. The story I tell myself. Using that to challenge the theories I'm making up when I'm scared or worried. Our next article by Stacy Lee is titled, The Forgotten Chinese Passengers of the Titanic Inspired a New Novel. In the fall of 2017, an email appeared in my inbox. It was one of those forwarded group emails my Chinese-Canadian mother-in-law enjoys sending me of interesting articles she's come across, the kind I usually hold off on reading until, well, later. As a writer of historical fiction, often centered around Asian Americans, I have become a repository of news clippings for family, friends, and complete strangers. But this one caught my eye. Forward, new film reveals fate of Chinese survivors of Titanic. I squinted hard, wondering how the words Chinese and Titanic might belong in the same sentence. Surely I hadn't read that right. I had never heard of any Chinese people sailing on the Titanic, let alone survivors. And judging by all the emphatic responses to my mother-in-law's email from her family and her friends, senior citizens like herself, no one else had either, even the ones who had visited Titanic museums like the ones in Belfast and Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. The article informed me that there were actually 8 Chinese passengers sailing on this ill-fated ship, seamen bound for a new route in the Caribbean. They were the largest group of non-European or North American passengers sailing on the ocean liner, and a remarkable 6 of them survived. Why had I never heard of these passengers? And how did the 75% of them survive when the survival rate for the third-class passengers was more like 25%? These questions bothered me, but I was in the throes of writing The Downstairs Girl, a YA book centered in a different part of the world in a different century, Atlanta 1890, and I didn't have space in my brain to nurture a story set in the cold waters of the Atlantic. In fact, I didn't think I could write a story about the Titanic at all, even once I finished the current book. I didn't know much about the Titanic beyond what I remembered from the movie, specifically not enough lifeboats, major classism, and the outrage of throwing a perfectly good diamond necklace into the sea. And though I loved a good ocean-faring story, I felt ill-equipped to write one, given my propensity for seasickness and general lack of knowledge as to how ships work. But as much as I tried to elbow away thoughts of the Chinese on the Titanic, the idea had already begun to take hold. Here was an opportunity to bring attention to a story that had not yet been told. Here was a chance to show others the far-reaching effects of the Chinese Exclusion Act, an act that from 1882 to 1943 prohibited Chinese from coming to the United States. For that is the reason you have likely never heard about these men. Every Titanic survivor, 705 in all, was allowed entry into the United States without question and given aid and medical relief. After all papers and money had been lost in the catastrophe, but not the Chinese. They were sent away within 24 hours of arriving in New York simply on the basis of race. Worse, they were shamed for surviving. Newspapers vilified them as cowards who had hidden under seats to survive. For Chinese people, being shamed is often considered a fate worse than death, so many of these survivors did not tell their stories to their families, another reason so little is known about these men. Researching this book wasn't easy. There was lots of information on the Titanic, but not so much on the Chinese passengers. The film The Six had not yet been released, and the British documentarians did not respond to my request for information. With so little to go on, I focused my efforts on learning about the Chinese sailors working in England during this time. Many of them came from Hong Kong and Guangdong. They probably spoke little English. After the iceberg hit, they probably hadn't understood the emergency orders from the crew, and with chaos swirling around them, they likely tried to do what they could to survive, get themselves on a lifeboat. Actually, the last person recovered from the Titanic was a Chinese man. He was found floating on a door. In fact, his plight inspired the scene in James Cameron's movie, in which Rose survives by clinging to a door, and infamously not sharing said door with Jack. The crew was reluctant to pick up this last Chinese man because they thought he was a Jap. But it's a good thing they did, as he ended up rowing the lifeboat to safety. Readers ask me, why do you choose to write about these stories that have fallen into the cracks? Because by showing the people who don't get the spotlight, I can make you wonder about them, maybe even care about them. And if I can do that, maybe you'll start looking for them yourself in those cracks, in those dark corners, in those hidden places. My novel, Luck of the Titanic, is not the true story of the Chinese passengers on the Titanic. It is the story of the acrobat Valora, a British Chinese girl who boards the Titanic, hoping to convince her twin brother, a sailor traveling with his company of Chinese seamen, to audition for the Ringling Brothers Circus and go with her to America. I'm a novelist, a literary entertainer, after all, and the true story of the Chinese passengers is not known. But even if what happened to them is never known, hopefully Luck of the Titanic will give them a permanent place on the ship of dreams. Stacy Lee is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels The Downstairs Girl, Luck of the Titanic, Under a Painted Sky, and Outrun the Moon, the winner of the Penn Center USA Literary Award for Young Adult Fiction. She is a fourth-generation Chinese American and a founding member of We Need Diverse Books. Born in Southern California, she graduated from UCLA and then got her law degree at UC Davis King Hall. She lives with her family outside San Francisco. Our next article by Grant Reiner is titled, How Three Kings Day is Celebrated. Three Kings Day, also known as Epiphany, is a celebration of the figures, referred to as the three wise men, the magi, or the three kings, who travel to pay homage to the recently born Jesus Christ, to hail him as a king in Bethlehem. It occurs on January 6th. The arrival of the magi is written about in the Bible's Gospel of Matthew, which says that Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar traveled for 12 days to reach Jesus. They each brought a unique gift. The event is commemorated in the song We Three Kings, and the trio is often portrayed in Three Kings Day parades everywhere from New York City to Madrid to Uruguay. For an overview about Three Kings Day, including its history and how it's celebrated, we spoke to Miriam Ortiz, a catechist at the Church of the Ascension in Manhattan. The holiday celebrates the three kings who visited with Jesus at his birth. The three kings, who are also known as the three wise men or the magi, are said to have followed a guiding star to Bethlehem to honor the birth of Jesus Christ and celebrate him as a king, per Encyclopedia Britannica. They first met with Herod, then governor of Judea, who told the trio to go to Bethlehem, according to El Museo del Barrio, which is known for its large Three Kings Day parade in New York. The museum also posited that, based on where they were traveling from, it can be surmised that they came from either Asia or Africa, though there is variance in the way the story itself is told. The museum wrote that Melchior is typically depicted as being Arab or descending from northern Africa, while Caspar is sometimes portrayed as Asian. They note that Balthazar is often shown as Ethiopian. Three Kings Day celebrates the welcoming of Jesus, says Ortiz. These three wise men came together after the birth of Jesus was foretold. They had faith, and that's what's really important. The example of faith traveled miles because they actually believed. I think that's what the three kings signify, faith, hope, and charity. The arrival of the three kings has been depicted in many works of art, including Adoration of the Magi paintings by artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Sandro Botticelli, and Hieronymus Bosch, as well as many nativity scenes. According to Ortiz, some of the artistic depictions of the arrival of the three kings have led to misconceptions, including that Jesus was a newborn when they greeted him. Common lore is that they got there and Jesus was still a baby, but that's not really true. That's just for art's sake. We know that it took months for the three kings to travel. Jesus could have been any age between 1 year and 2 years old, she explains, also noting that the Bible says they visited the house, not the stable. I think for artistic significance, they show a baby, but really Jesus was much older. January 6th is an important date for Christians in countries around the world. As noted by the New York Times, Three Kings Day is also known as Epiphany and celebrated in many cultures. In the Czech Republic, for example, there are parades as well as a tradition where people plunge themselves into the freezing cold Vltava River to look for a wooden crucifix. Per that same piece, the tradition of diving into bodies of water is also common in Russia, Greece, and Bulgaria, as well as among the Greek Orthodox in Australia, where it is known as Blessing of the Waters. According to the museum, the Epiphany is celebrated by the Anglican, Eastern, and Roman Catholic churches. Per the BBC, many Orthodox sects of Christianity celebrate the Epiphany on January 19th. The January 6th date is celebrated by Catholics and within Vatican City through a Sunday Mass and a statement from the Pope. We need to arise to get up from our sedentary lives and prepare for a journey, Pope Francis said during his 2019 address. We also need to shine to be clothed in God who is light day by day until we are fully clothed in Jesus. In Spanish-speaking countries and areas, the day features large celebrations. From Spain to Puerto Rico to American cities like Miami and New York, with significant Catholic Spanish-speaking populations, Three Kings Day is often honored. Madrid has a grand vibrant parade on the evening of January 5th, for example. In Puerto Rico, Ortiz says that the holiday is celebrated for an additional 8 days afterwards, known as Octavitas. To commemorate the day, Three Kings bread is typically eaten. According to Velas magazine, Three Kings bread, also known as Rosca de Reyes, is an oval-shaped dish made of sweet dough and typically flavored with additions like orange extract, orange blossom water, crystallized fruits, jam, and sugar paste. Ortiz explains that the cake is also popular in Mexico and France, under the name Galette de Roy, which, like Rosca de Reyes, translate to Cake of the Kings. She says that in some communities, a tiny baby doll or some other small item is hidden within the cake. Traditionally, children leave treats for camels. Ortiz, whose parents come from Puerto Rico, shares some of the stories they told her about how they celebrated the holiday. Some of the ways of acknowledging the days are pretty close to Christmas festivities, particularly with traditions related to Santa Claus. As children, my parents would place hay and water under the bed for the camels so that when the three kings arrived, they could feed them. If they had a piece of bread or something that they could leave for the three kings also, they would, she explains. In the morning, the water and hay would be gone and a toy would be left in their place. In a 2017 interview with the Washington Post, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who was a New Yorker of Puerto Rican descent, described Three Kings Day in his household growing up. He talked about gathering grass and hay for the camels and leaving it in a shoebox near his bed. Just like you would leave milk and cookies for Santa, we're leaving grass and hay for the camels to eat because they've obviously come a long way if they're coming to Upper Manhattan to bring you toys, he joked. According to NBC News, in countries like Uruguay, Mexico, and Spain, young kids leave their shoes out to be filled with gifts on the night before the holiday. Three Kings Day is connected to Christmas. Three Kings Day and Christmas share not only a season, but other similarities too. The key difference is that Christmas itself has both a religious and broad secular connotation in culture, whereas Three Kings Day is celebrated largely by Christians. In Uruguay, which is a secular country, Three Kings Day is also known as Day of the Child, or Dia del Niño. El Museo del Barrio noted many of the customs associated with Three Kings Day, which include door-to-door holiday caroling, and the consumption of sweets and group meals are similar to Christmas. The songs are often also sung around Christmas and use traditional instruments like the güiro, cuatro, and maracas. Nativity scenes, which are frequently made and displayed by Christians around Christmas, often depict the very moment the Three Kings Day celebrates, and they feature Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar. As covered by NBC News, the celebration of Three Kings Day in some Latinx households in America may be decreasing. The piece cited a Pew Research Center study that noted the percentage of Latinx people who said their parents brought them cultural celebrations had been fading. According to the New York Times, in Spain and some Latin American countries, Christmas gifts are actually given on Epiphany, and in some places, young children pen letters to the Magi in a way that many kids write notes to Santa. In his 2019 address on Epiphany, Pope Francis took the opportunity to connect the two holidays further, instructing people to be charitable not just towards one another, but to God as well. Let us ask ourselves this question. At Christmas, do we bring gifts to Jesus for his party, or do we only exchange gifts among ourselves, he said. If we went to the Lord empty-handed, today we can remedy that. There are three gifts associated with Three Kings Day. Per the Biblical Archaeology Society, the meaning of the three gifts brought on Three Kings Day has been debated by Christian scholars over the years. The items themselves were gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which according to the same source were typical items presented to honor a king or deity in the ancient world. While the worth of gold is obvious, it is believed that there is actually more value to the gifts than previously realized. According to Simon Cotton's account in Chemistry World, the frankincense and myrrh may have especially had significant value beyond just bringing a pleasant odor. He revealed that research has been done on the pain-killing properties of myrrh molecules, and the boswellic acid that is part of frankincense resin is known to ameliorate issues with both inflammation and arthritis. Frankincense was traditionally burned in temples by the ancient Egyptians, Romans, and Greeks to symbolize prayers rising to the gods. Historically, myrrh was more often used in perfumes and medicines for healing wounds. It is put into mouthwashes and toothpaste to this day, and to preserve bodies, Cotton wrote. According to Ortiz, each item also had a symbolic meaning related to the birth of Jesus. For gold to be presented to Jesus was to signify that he was King of Kings. Frankincense was used for worship or prayer. They were there to worship the child Jesus, says Ortiz. And myrrh was used for embalming and in death. Its significance is showing that Jesus Christ will give his life for us. El Museo del Barrio noted that the gold is typically credited to Melchior, the myrrh to Balthazar, and the frankincense from Caspar. Of course, Three Kings Day festivities will be affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, but for those who believe, just like the Magi and their camels traveled all the way to Bethlehem on faith, families will find a way to somehow celebrate this important day. Article by Bridget Early is titled Noche Buena Celebrations and Traditions Around the World. Though there are many widespread Christmas traditions, holiday celebrations look different not only from family to family, but also from culture to culture. While your loved ones may not do much more than don matching jammies, sip hot cocoa, or binge holiday movies on Christmas Eve, others put much more stock in the evening, like Italians who celebrate the Feast of the Seven Fishes, or Hispanic people who celebrate Noche Buena. What exactly is Noche Buena, you're wondering? The English translation of the Spanish term Noche Buena is good night, says Juan Aguirre, executive director of the Mexican culture nonprofit Mano a Mano. It's also the name of a familiar Christmas plant, the poinsettia. The flor de Noche Buena is native to Mexico, and it's coined as such because it turns a very bright red shade right around Christmas time. But when used in the context of Christmas, Noche Buena refers to a special event that takes place on December 24th. Noche Buena is a holiday celebration for Christian Latinx people around the world. In the simplest terms, Noche Buena is a Christmas Eve celebration for Christian Latinx populations. It's not to be confused with Medianoche, which refers to a lavish midnight feast that takes place on New Year's Eve. Noche Buena is a time for family and friends to gather and eat, drink, be merry, and for some, celebrate the religious component of the holiday, the birth of Jesus. In many countries, including Mexico and the Philippines, the holiday is even more important than Christmas Day itself, according to Aguirre, with the party lasting all afternoon and well into the night. Though Christians believe Christ was born on Christmas Day, an occasion commonly celebrated with a mass, Latinx and Hispanic cultures that celebrate Noche Buena focus on the night before Christ's birth, or Christmas Eve. It's an anticipatory celebration where families gather to eat and often exchange gifts. Meanwhile, Christmas Day itself is more relaxing. Celebrations vary widely depending on your region, says Aguirre. Still, there are some constants. Typically, the night is extremely festive, and at its core, no matter where you are, the evening revolves around plenty of food, music, and time with family. The evening also commonly includes a more formal aspect for Christians of various nationalities, like attending Mass. Sometimes this Mass takes place before dinner, but the more traditional Mass is called La Misa del Gallo, or Midnight Mass. The food served on Noche Buena is largely dependent on geographical location. In Latin America, food tends to be very localized, says Aguirre. As such, you'll see wide variations on holiday tables, depending on where you're celebrating Noche Buena. For example, if you attend a Caribbean, largely Cuban or Puerto Rican Noche Buena, you'll likely enjoy lechon or roast pig. In Mexico, the celebration more closely resembles what Americans know as Thanksgiving, a big family feast complete with tamales, pozole, a traditional hominy stew, and pavo or turkey, says Aguirre. In central Mexico, families may serve mixiote, traditional pit barbecued meat. Across the world in the Philippines, where Noche Buena is also celebrated, revelers indulge in traditional foods like hamonado, pineapple-infused chicken or pork, sontagon soup, a hot noodle soup, and socolate, hot chocolate. On Noche Buena, revelers engage in many traditional activities, including breaking piñatas. Like the food served, the activities that take place during a Noche Buena celebration depend on the region and, of course, the traditions families choose to adopt. In some countries, the party begins 9 days before Noche Buena with celebrations called Las Posadas. These celebrations, literally meaning lodging, commemorate the journey of Mary and Joseph from Nazareth to Bethlehem, says Aguirre. At a posada, guests participate in an outdoor procession near the home, singing villancicos, or holiday songs, and building piñatas. The breaking of piñatas is significant because it symbolizes the rejection of sin, says Aguirre. Traditional piñatas, which have 7 points, are supposed to be beautiful and alluring, he explains. When the sin is broken, the candy within represents a reward from heaven. In other countries, family may simply enjoy each other's company and some games. Dominoes, for example, is especially popular in Caribbean countries like Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. In Latin America, specifically Mexico, American traditions like waiting for Santa Claus and decorating a Christmas tree have also become more central themes of the holiday. But one big difference, according to Aguirre, is that Mexicans put a nativity scene, not gifts, under the tree. Still, some families opt to exchange gifts after midnight and the early hours of Christmas. By Ariana Davis is titled, A Vermont Road Trip Reminded Me That Some of the Best Travel is Here in the U.S. After I graduated from college and moved to New York on my own, the city kept me in a constant state of wonder. On weekends, I take myself on long walks to explore the best museums, latest trendy restaurants, or coolest bookshops Manhattan had to offer. I was enamored. Simply venturing downtown to neighborhoods like Soho or the West Village sounded so chic to the ears of a suburban Maryland native. But after a few years and far too many overpriced meals, delayed subway rides, and grumpy run-ins with other dismayed commuters, the new car smell of New York began to wear off for me. Suddenly, I had an intense itch to get out of town and go somewhere, anywhere. It was right around that time that my best friend announced she was going to spend her summer in law school abroad in Paris. She had barely said the words before I booked a ticket. That first trip to Paris changed my life. I came home to New York blathering to anyone who would listen about the City of Lights and its romantic architecture, sparkling Eiffel Tower, and leisurely long lunches fueled by glasses of wine. I had officially caught the travel bug in a major way. While other women my age were saving up their extra dollars for shoes or handbags, I was pocketing away savings for future plane tickets and stays at tiny boutique hotels. Over the next few years, because I was lucky enough to have said savings and the privilege to do so, I would find ways to travel on a budget to everywhere from London, Barcelona, and Amsterdam to Bangkok and the islands of Thailand, and make a few return visits to Paris too. When I finally met a spontaneity-prone boyfriend who was as open to adventure as I was, we hit destinations like Havana, Cuba, and Cartagena, Colombia, making memories together around the world. I had become a full-fledged wanderluster, someone who spent hours on Pinterest and Instagram combing through travel photos and signing up for every discount travel email alert and newsletter possible. But whenever I would get notifications for local destinations, train rides to North Carolina or hotels on sale in upstate New York, I would scroll right past them. To me, cities that were here in the U.S., and especially those within driving distance, didn't count as real travel. A true getaway, I thought, meant visiting a city where I would arrive after an exhausted few hours of flying to be culture shocked by the language, food, and sights, or all of the above. And then I got invited by Land Rover on a press trip to visit Vermont, with the opportunity to drive their new 19 MY Ranger Rover Sport PHEV, first to the small town of Manchester, Vermont, then the college town of Burlington for the weekend. At first, I almost passed, thinking, shouldn't I save my vacation time for a real vacation? But then I looked at my boyfriend, with whom I desperately needed some quality time, and said, it's just a weekend. Why the heck not? So that's how I, someone who knows nothing about cars and drives a few times a year when she visits her parents back home in Maryland, ended up driving a luxury SUV on the open road to the state of Vermont for the weekend. I wasn't initially very excited about taking a trip to a state that's essentially right next door, read, not exotic in my mind. And as someone who isn't a great driver, I also wasn't super stoked about road tripping. But before I knew it, I found my body relaxing behind the wheel, oohing and aahing with my significant other who was sending videos to all of his friends because he was super pumped about the Range's bells and whistles. Smooth drive, buttery leather seats, mini fridge in the armrest. As green trees whizzed by the window and Ed Sheeran blasted from the sound system, I thought to myself, maybe this whole road tripping in the USA idea ain't so bad after all. We arrived at the Kempton Taconic Hotel in Manchester right at sunset, and I was immediately charmed. The lobby decor was warm, full of New England touches, with a scent in the air that was at once woodsy and spicy, like a fireplace had given Christmas a maple-laced hug. Dinner at the hotel's restaurant, Copper Grouse, featured delicious comfort food from soft pretzel bites and hand-cut French fries to pan-seared scallops and a juicy cheeseburger. It was exactly the fuel we needed to get prepared for the Land Rover experience driving school the next day, where a certified instructor took this nervous driver off-roading on a course deep in the woods. Woods that, I should mention, were populated with hills still covered in the post-winter ice that was finally beginning to melt into spring. To say I was nervous would be an understatement, but we spent the next 3 hours patiently being taught the many ways the Range Rover Sport can handle any terrain, even wading through a 6-foot-high puddle of water or a huge pile of rock-hard snow. At one point, I was driving through a mound of ice so high, two of the car's wheels were completely off the ground. Though I was nervous, I felt safe. Those cars were made for this kind of thing, and afterward, I felt much more confident in my skills as a driver. Here in Vermont, I found myself doing something I never would have done in New York City, or anywhere for that matter. That first dinner at the Copper Grouse, by the way, was only our initial introduction to the food culture of Vermont, where everything is farm to table. A trend that leads the chefs at basically any dining establishment to get real creative with their dishes. We spent our final dinner in Manchester at Bournebrook Farm, an enchanting country estate straight out of a fairy tale that you can rent for events or an overnight stay from its hospitable owner, Jeff, who is brimming with the kinds of stories you want to take back home and tell your friends. That evening, I tried squab for the first time ever. Fun fact, apparently squab is pigeon. And a goat cheesecake topped with caramelized apples that I can still taste in my dreams. Next, it was off to Burlington, where we stayed at the Hotel Vermont, which felt uniquely, well, Vermont, but somehow in a different way. This college town was visibly more eclectic and urban than its sister Manchester. As soon as we arrived, we were off to tour the Soda Plant, a small business base camp in Burlington that's home to burgeoning businesses, including a boutique coffee retailer, Brio Coffee Works, and the winery and tasting room co-cellars. But nothing was more Burlington to me than Foam Brewers, the heart of Vermont's rising brewery scene, which offers the latest in craft beer, including a sweet pink option that I, a beer newbie, actually loved, while also putting on events to showcase the work of local musicians and artists. That night over dinner at Hotel Vermont's Juniper Bar and Restaurant, after devouring plates of Maple Wind Farm fried chicken and rabbit ragu chevre noche, I realized, in just 4 days in two cities in a state not far from New York, I had discovered a destination that was unlike any place I had ever been. This wasn't Paris or Thailand or Barcelona. It was an experience all its own. For years, I defined travel as something that required hours standing in security at the airport, long flights, and months of saving money to accomplish. But a quick road trip had opened my eyes to sights, sounds, and foods I'd never experienced. The next morning on the drive back to New York, I let the window down so I could feel the cool Vermont air blow through my hair. And then I felt something familiar, the travel bug scratching again. Only this time, I was ready to check out more of what America has to offer me, and I can't wait to see where life takes me next. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled Differences Between the Harry Potter Books and Movies. As far as Potterheads go, there are those of us who have A, read each of the seven books multiple times, B, binged all eight of the movies more than we can count, or C, done all of the above. But whether we're looking at the novels or films, both are masterfully done and based on the prose and imagination of J.K. Rowling. Still, as fans, we can't help but compare the two, because with each of the movies lasting well over 2 hours, and Rowling's books each including more than 76,000 words, there were bound to be some elements that were lost in translation. Below, we've outlined key plot points from both, analyzing the most crucial differences between the books and movies. And yes, Harry's eyes are number one. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Number one, Daniel Radcliffe, who has blue eyes, was allergic to colored contacts, so in the films, the boy who lived's eyes were not green like they are in the novels. Number two, Rowling described Hermione as having extremely bushy hair and large front teeth, but as we can see, Emma Watson did not. Number three, in contrast to Rupert Grint's appearance, Rowling describes Ron as tall and lanky with a long nose and blue eyes. Grint's eyes are green. Number four, Aunt Petunia and Dudley are blonde, but in the films, they're brunette. Number five, the movies never mention Hagrid's motorbike was once Sirius Black's. Number six, in the film, the snake Harry speaks Parseltongue to at the zoo is a Burmese python, but in the book, it's a boa constrictor. Number seven, in the novel, Harry met Draco Malfoy and rejected his friendship in Diagon Alley, but in the film, this happens at Hogwarts before the Sorting Hat ceremony. Number eight, the Sorting Hat sings a song before every ceremony, but not in the movie. Number nine, in the book, Voldemort kills Quirrell by leaving his head, but in the film, Harry kills Quirrell by touching his face. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Number one, in the book, Mr. Weasley fixes Harry's glasses in Diagon Alley instead of Hermione. Number two, big screen Hermione is aware of the term mudblood, while the book character needs to be taught its meaning by Ron. Number three, the movie never clarifies that Mr. Filch is a squib and has no magic. Number four, in the film, the heir of Slytherin message is written in blood, while in the book, it's paint. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Number one, Harry pretends to be Neville Longbottom while on the night bus in the novel. Number two, there is no Hogwarts choir in the book, but you see them perform in the third film. Number three, in the book, Sir Cadogan's portrait replaces the fat lady's after she's attacked by Sirius Black. Number four, on the big screen, it's never shown that Harry wins Hogwarts Quidditch Cup. Number five, the film doesn't explain the origin story of the Marauders. James Potter, Prongs, Sirius, Padfoot, Remus Lupin, Moony, and Peter Pettigrew, Wormtail, or their Marauder's Map and Lupin's connection to the Shrieking Shack. Number 6. Harry was joined by Ron and Hermione in the novel when he eavesdropped on Fudge's Leaky Cauldron conversation. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Number 1. Percy Weasley's job at the Ministry and the betrayal of his family isn't in the film. Number 2. Dumbledore calmly confronted Harry about putting his name in the Goblet of Fire in the book, whereas in the movie he was rather angry and intense. Number 3. Head of the Department of Magical Games and Sports, Ludo Bagman was omitted from the film, as his character was combined with Barty Crouch's. Number 4. In the books, journalist Rita Skeeter can turn into a beetle and is an unregistered animagus. Number 5. Hermione's Spew, the Society for the Promotion of Elfish Welfare, wasn't mentioned in the film. Number 6. Neville gave Harry the Gillyweed for the second Triwizard Tournament task, but it was actually Dobby in the book. Number 7. Voldemort has red eyes in the books, not white. Number 8. After Harry won the Triwizard Tournament, he gave his 1,000 galleon winnings to Fred and George so they could start Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, which isn't in the film. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. Number 1. Quidditch is not featured at all in the 5th film, including Ron being named Keeper and Professor Umbridge banning Harry, Fred, and George from Quidditch. Ginny then replaced Harry as Seeker. Number 2. Hagrid told Harry about Thestrals in the book, while Luna Lovegood did in the movie. Number 3. The film doesn't show the full extent of Snape's worst memory, which involved Lily Potter and the Marauders. Number 4. While Cho Chang spills the beans about Dumbledore's army in the film, it's actually Marietta Edgecombe in the book. Number 5. Harry goes on a date with Cho Chang in the novel, but not in the movie. Number 6. Ron and Hermione are prefects, but not in the movie. Number 7. It's revealed in the books, but not the movies, that Professor Trelawney's prophecy about the chosen one who will defeat Voldemort, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the 7th month dies, could have also been applied to Neville Longbottom. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Number 1. Harry inherited Grimwald Place and Creature in the book after Sirius Black's death. Number 2. In the book, Bill and Fleur are living at the Burrow planning their wedding, and Fleur clashes with Mrs. Weasley. Number 3. After Draco leaves Harry unconscious on Hogwarts Express, Tonks finds him in the novel, but it's Luna in the film. Number 4. The story of the pureblood Gaunt family, Voldemort's descendants, is cut from the film. Number 5. Though the Burrow is attacked by Death Eaters during the Christmas on the big screen, that never happens in the book. Number 6. In the film, it's not mentioned that the werewolf Greyback turned Lupin. Number 7. Years earlier, Dumbledore rejected Voldemort's defense against the Dark Arts application, which may be why the position is cursed. Number 8. Ginny hid the Half-Blood Prince's book in the Room of Requirement in the film, but Harry did it in the book. Number 9. For the novel, Harry and Ginny's first kiss is in front of the whole school during the Quidditch match. Number 10. It's not explained in the film that Snape named himself the Half-Blood Prince because he's half-wizard, half-muggle, and his mother's maiden name is Prince. Number 11. Bill Weasley is bitten by Fenrir Greyback in the book. Number 12. Ginny and Harry are in a relationship throughout much of the book, but Harry breaks up with her for her safety. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Number 1. Harry's farewell with the Dursleys is omitted from the film, including Dudley thanking Harry for saving his life, but it is a deleted scene in the adaptation. Number 2, the backstory of Regulus Black, a former Death Eater and Sirius's brother, is not expanded upon in the films. Number 3, Remus's reveal of Tonks' pregnancy, the birth of their son Teddy, and the fact that Harry is the godfather isn't mentioned in the film. Number 4. Harry and Hermione do not dance together in the tent in the books like they do in the film. Number 5. In the novel, Harry discovers the message on the snitch soon after he receives it, as opposed to in the film when he figures it out much later. Number 6, Peter Pettigrew dies in the books after being compelled to strangle himself with the hand gifted to him by Voldemort. Number 7, it's Harry's idea to release the Gringotts dragon in the novel, but Hermione's in the films. Number 8, Dumbledore's full backstory, from his friendship with Gellert Grindelwald to the tragedy of his sister Ariana, isn't detailed in the movie. Number 9, Percy is very much present at the Battle of Hogwarts. Number 10, in the book, Hermione and Ron's first kiss is in front of Harry, after they destroy the Horcrux. Number 11, Harry breaks the Elder Wand in half at the end of the film, but in the book, he uses it to fix his wand and then returns it to Dumbledore's grave. Missing film characters. Number 1, Charlie Weasley, Ron's second oldest brother who works with dragons in Romania. Number 2, Peeves, a mischievous Hogwarts poltergeist. Number 3, Winky, Barty Crouch's drunken former house elf. Number 4, Professor Binns, a ghost who teaches history and magic at Hogwarts. Number 5, Andromeda and Ted Tonks, Nymphadora's Tonks' parents. General notes. Number 1, James and Lily Potter were just 21 when they died, but were portrayed by much older actors. Same with Remus, Sirius, and Peter, who would have been around 32 when they were first introduced in Prisoner of Azkaban. Number 2, Potterheads have long complained about how Ron was portrayed in the films. While he largely served as comic relief, many of his braver and more intelligent moments throughout the books were given to Hermione on the big screen. Number 3, fans also feel that Ginny was dealt a disservice in the films, as she was much more outgoing, vivacious, and dynamic in the books.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.